Welcome back, everyone. Hope you enjoyed your time seeing one another and touching base a little bit and getting ready for Job. We've been in Job for a while here now, for a number of weeks, minus last week, where I again thank Corey for covering last week and sharing. But we've aside from last week, we've been in the book of Job for a number of weeks. And so let me give you a sort of a recap of where we have been before we get into this week's, because every week has been very different. The first week we covered those first two chapters in Job, where Job is described as someone who is highly righteous with a high degree of integrity, and God validates that. God confirms it. When God is in discussion with the accuser, with the challenger, the accuser will then say to God, "But does Job serve you for nothing?" And there's a two-pronged accusation that comes out of that. One is a suggestion to God that Job is only righteous because Job gets something out of it. And then the second part of that accusation is that if Job only serves God because he gets something out of it, then God, your system of rewarding and protecting your followers is actually deeply flawed, because it undermines the motivations for living a righteous life. You can't be righteous if you're actually only doing it to get something out of it. And so that's the challenger's two-pronged accusation to God. And we worked through that in week one. The second week, we took the huge chunk from chapter 3 to chapter 27, which is all of the back and forth. First, Job's friends come and they lament silently, or they weep with him, but they just spend time with him grieving, but silently. They're not talking to him about anything. And then after a week of grieving in silence, Job starts to lament, and he curses the day he was born. He says he wished he'd never been born, because all of this pain he's now going through, it just makes it seem like it would have been better if he'd never been born. Well, after he finishes his lament, the friends then go back and forth with him, constantly telling him, chapter after chapter after chapter, that he's getting what he deserves, that he's actually sinned in some way. He needs to confess it and repent of it so that he can get back to the life he once lived before. And Job will respond over and over again, insisting on the fact that he is innocent. He's not insisting on the fact that he's sinless. No one, nothing in the book is trying to say that Job lived a sinless life. But he lived a life with a high degree of integrity, and he lived his life in such a way that what he is now going through is not the result of any particular sin. That's Job's contention. He says, "I didn't do anything to deserve this." And the friends will sort of quote scripture to him and say, "But God punishes the wicked and God rewards the righteous. Therefore, you must have sinned." And Job's response over and over again is, "Yeah, I agree with you about the fact that God rewards the righteous and he punishes the wicked, but it doesn't apply to me." That's what Job says over and over again. And the friends eventually run out of things to say to him. And so we hit on the third week this interruption in the dialogue where it's the narrator, most likely, who then introduces a poem about wisdom. And it's very strange, as we talked about, because this poem about wisdom, you'd expect a discussion about justice, about what's fair, because Job and his friends have been talking about what's fair. The friends say, it's fair for God to punish the wicked. It's fair for God to reward the righteous. That's how God operates. He operates on a system of fairness or justice. And Job's saying, "I am not receiving that, but I should be." And so he is lamenting the fact that God is not acting in a way that is fair. But he's crying out and saying, "I should be getting my day in court with God, so that in my day in court, he can actually give me what I deserve, because I haven't been getting it." Both parties, Job and his friends, are operating on the principle that life is fair or life should be fair. That's what the discussion has been. And then all of a sudden we hit chapter 28 and it's about wisdom. We're like, where does this come from? What's this here for? The narrator is alluding to the fact that later on in the book, God is going to challenge the assumptions that Job and his friends make about the fact that life should be fair. I'm not going to get into that now. We touched on it a little bit, and that's going to be all of next week. So I'm not going to deal with that a whole lot more. You can bring it up during the discussion time if you want to a little bit, but I'm going to focus elsewhere today because we are now moving on from chapter 28 into chapters 29 through 37. And so this is not, we're in a different section of the book now. In that previous section, it had been back and forth, Job and his friends talking back and forth, and one party responds to the other party. So those are the dialogues. That's the section of dialogue. We're now going to move into a section of the book where a single character is just going to talk, and it isn't really a back and forth dialogue. It's just, they call it the discourse section. Job is going to just talk for three chapters here, and then someone else is going to talk for five chapters, and then God is going to talk for three chapters, something like that. So that's how this next section of the book works. Job is going to start his discussion, discourse, and he's going to start by just lamenting and longing for the days that he had experienced. Life was so good when, he'll say, life was so good when the friendship of God was on my tent. Just simply a way of saying, my life experienced so much of God's goodness and God's blessing. And it was in my tent. It wasn't just me personally, but my whole, everything that I sort of spread out over, everything that sort of contained within my life, my home, it's like God just blessed my home, my property, my acreage, my farm. God blessed every place that I drive to. The friendship of God was over everything. And it was a wonderful experience. And now he looks back on that and he aches and he longs for a day gone by. He'll say, I long for the days when my children were all around me. And we remind ourselves that Job lost 10 children. So he's going to grieve the fact that his children are no longer with him. He'll grieve the fact that he'll say, I long for the day when my steps were washed with milk. And you're like, what? What does that mean? Well, Job was so rich that instead of when they went to mop the floor, it's like it's easier to grab all the extra milk we have than to go to the well, because we have so much, we can use milk to wash our floor. That's he's just talking about how rich he was, how much God had blessed him. I long for the day when my steps were washed with milk. And then he'll go on and he'll talk about longing for the days when he would go out into public and whatever he said was the final word on any discussion. He'll talk about being in the city gates with the other nobles. And when he declares, this is what's right, this is what we should do, the discussion was over. Because everyone agreed with him. They recognized that he was a righteous and wise and godly person, and they went with what he said. They would defer to him. And he'll talk about how he lived a righteous life, and his decisions would be on behalf of the poor. He would be looking after the poor. He would be making decisions. He would be executing justice on behalf of others. And so why is he not getting justice now? What the heck? So that is a summary of Job's lament in chapter 29. And then in chapter 30, he's going to go on and say that he's lamenting the fact that he is now, he was first this elevated, respected person in the community, but now he's become this social outcast. And he'll talk about the fact that the men before, there were men before that I wouldn't have even let them work with my dogs. I would have seen that as, I would have respected them too much to even put them with my dogs and with my flock. But now they're children, like these nobodies already, and whose children, have no social status, because of course, children don't have status in the ancient world. Their children will even mock me now. It's like I've gone from the very top to the very bottom of society, and he's grieving that. And then he's going to go on in chapter 31, and we're going to park here a little bit longer. He's going to go on in chapter 31 and declare his innocence. But the way that he's going to do it is that he's going to... he's going to take a curse on himself. He's going to proclaim a curse over himself in order to say, if I'm not innocent, may all of this stuff that I'm about to say, may it all happen to me. So he'll say, like, if I ever lusted after a woman, may my wife now go and lust after someone else. He'll say, if I ever raised my hand against the poor, may my very arm be broken off and my shoulder, my arm fall right out of my shoulder, that kind of thing. He'll say, if I ever trusted in riches, if I ever worshiped idols, if I ever kept any of my sins hidden and I didn't confess them, if even he'll go so far as to say, if even my land, my property, the earth has something against me, may God strike me dead. Like that's more or less what he's getting at. He invokes all of these curses in order to say, if I'm not innocent, then may God strike me dead right now. It's kind of posing a challenge to God to say, Are you going to declare me innocent, or are you going to strike me dead? And if you don't, then it's an implicit statement that I am innocent and that you agree with me. It's just an astonishing thing that he says. And then we hit chapter 32, and we're just going to look at the first five verses. And so this will be sort of our bridge. We're gonna come back to that curse in just a minute. But chapter 32, after Job has finished that curse, he says, this is what the narrator says. So these three men, speaking of Job's friends that have been interacting with him and telling him he's guilty and needs to confess. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. That's not a good thing. Then Elihu, son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, he became angry. He was angry at Job because he justified himself rather than God. He was angry also at Job's three friends because they'd found no answer, though they had declared Job to be in the wrong. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. But when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouths of these three men, he became angry again. Now, before we pick up on Elihu and his anger, what's important to notice are those first two verses and the things that we just talked about. The first is that Job has actually become righteous in his own eyes, and that's not a good thing. And he has justified himself rather than God. So that's verses 1 and 2 of chapter 32 there. So let's talk about this curse first. Job has called this self-curse upon himself. He's in previous chapters, he has called on God over and over again. He wants his day in court with God, where he can spread out his case before God, and then God can declare him to be innocent. That the argument Job has been having with his friends would be resolved, and Job's status would be upheld as someone who is righteous and innocent. But he's not yet received his day in court. And Job has decided that he is now going to take it one step further. He's going to take it into his own hands and say, may God strike me dead if I'm guilty of anything. It's actually an attempt to twist God's arm into acting. Because if God doesn't strike him dead, it's implicitly a statement from God that Job is innocent because he's called a curse on himself. And if he does not receive that curse, it's a way of putting words in God's mouth and saying, yeah, therefore you are declared to be innocent because you didn't receive what you've just called on yourself. And it implicitly would declare Job innocent, but it's also, if that declares Job innocent, what it does is it ends up putting God in the wrong. And that's what verse 32 is getting at, because it justifies Job at the expense of what God is doing in the moment. Now, God is going to come back to that in chapter 38 and on. So we will pick that up more in the coming weeks, but the narrator here confirms it. The narrator is the one who says Job has not only been righteous in his own eyes, Job has justified himself rather than God. And that comes out of the curse that he has called on himself and the way that he's trying to force God to act, to act in order to declare, to vindicate him is probably the best way of putting it. Job wants God to vindicate him by not striking him dead. So he's going to force God to act in a way. This comes right on the heels of chapter 28, where chapter 28 talked about wisdom, and it concluded with the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Job is not acting according to the fear of the Lord at this moment. The fear of the Lord means submission. It means that whoever God is and whatever he is doing, we can protest against that, but ultimately we still submit to who he is and to what he's doing. And Job is no longer doing that. Job is starting to get manipulative. And then we get introduced to Elihu. And this is the first that we have heard of him. The book up till now has only referred to Job's three friends. And then suddenly this young punk is here. And we're like, who are you? Where did you come from? And it's strange. Elihu is a Hebrew name. But if you trace the family here, it's still a Gentile. It's an Edomite family, Edomite territory, and so on. So these are all Gentiles. But anyway, Elihu is a young punk, and he is very, very sure of himself. In fact, he will go on in another chapter to declare that he'll say, "One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." And he's speaking about himself. He says, "I know the way it is, people, and I've let you guys speak because you're older than I am, and the older people, the wiser people should go first. But now I'm pretty upset the fact that you guys haven't found an answer for Job, and I'm upset about the way Job has been acting, and now I'm angry." And the narrator, did you hear that I brought that out as I was reading it? The narrator says four times that this guy is angry. And then Elihu will go on and actually describe the fact that he's bursting. Like, you could just picture this guy, and he's like, he's getting upset, right? Like, he's jittery. It reminds me of the joke I heard on the radio one time. I don't know who the comedian was that was telling this joke, but he says, I got both of my emotions. I only have two emotions, and I got both of them from my dad. And they are rage and suppressed rage. And both of those have been coming out at this point in Elihu. Like, that's what Elihu reminds me of. Like, he's just upset. And he'll talk about how I've been biting my tongue, but I can't do it anymore. And that should raise some questions for us. It really should. When the narrator just says over and over again that this guy's angry, and then Job or Elihu's going to describe his anger, and he feels like he's bursting, like, we ought to probably ask ourselves where that's coming from. It's probably worth asking. We should probably ask that about ourselves when we're bursting too. But I'll pick that up in a few minutes. Elihu is going to make one good point. It's a brilliant point, and it's completely irrelevant. That's sort of the funny thing about Elihu. He's exactly like the other friends. His excellent point that none of the friends have mentioned so far is that God sometimes uses suffering to prevent us from getting to a place where we would experience and do something worse than what we are currently doing or experiencing. God sometimes will insert suffering into a person's life in order to prevent them from doing something even worse and reaping worse consequences down the road. And it's a good point. It's a biblical point. The Apostle Paul will make this point at one point. He'll say that, I received a thorn in my flesh in order to keep me from becoming proud. So I had to go through suffering in order that I wouldn't experience something even worse. Elihu is making that point. He's simply saying that there are times where suffering in our lives is not the result of sin, like you other three friends have been saying. Sometimes we go through suffering so that God can help us out by keeping us from something even worse. It's a great point. It's brilliant. It hasn't come up so far in the discussion, but it's completely irrelevant. Because we know, based on everything that's happened in this book and based on chapters 1 and 2, that Job is not suffering so that God can prevent him from getting something worse. That has never been part of this story up to this point. It's a completely irrelevant point. It's completely true and completely irrelevant. It just doesn't apply to this particular spot, to this particular story. So we get to a point in the book of Job where it looks like there's no human being in this book that can give an answer for why Job is suffering. Job doesn't know. Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, those first three friends, they don't know. They think they do, but they don't. Elihu now comes and he gives his own answer, and he thinks he's right, and he's angry, and he's very sure he's right. They all have something true to say, and all have something irrelevant to say, because none of it applied to Job. And we come to a point where people can quote chapter and verse. They can say that this is the way that God acts, and they're right. God does sometimes use suffering to punish sin. And we talked about that the second week. We can quote chapter and verse on that. And Elihu is right, that sometimes God does use suffering to prevent us from getting to something worse. We can quote chapter and verse on that. They're true, but they're irrelevant. And we get to a point where no one has an answer. And we need to be able to live with that. You and I need to be able to live with the fact that there aren't always answers for why we go through what we go through. We can say with the book of Job that there is an answer in heaven. We can assert that. We can take Job to be teaching that at least in this particular case, there was an answer, but no human being ever got access to it in this book. And that's often like our lives, friends. You go through something and you just don't know why. We ask God why. You're welcome to ask God why. It's not wrong to ask God why. My God, why have you forsaken me? That question did not get answered. Sometimes they won't. And that's part of what Job teaches us. What else can we take away from this book? Job, when it comes to Job, don't try to manipulate God. Let's learn to ask our questions and let's learn to live with unanswered questions. It's right to ask. It is okay. We should. But this isn't a life that is dependent on answers. It is a life that is dependent on submission to God, that we fear God and we keep his commands. That's what the end of the book of Ecclesiastes will conclude. In the end, nothing else matters except fear God and keep his commands. And it is worth asking the question, and we will pick it up next week. Should life always be fair? The book of Job is going to give you an answer you don't like to that question. It's a really hard answer to receive. We'll pick that up next week. When it comes to Elihu, be suspicious of your anger. If you or someone else says, I just got to say this, that's a statement about you. I just got to say this isn't for their benefit. It's about you. And you have revealed what's going on inside you. And that's Elihu. Be suspicious of your anger. Counselors will tell you that anger is generally a secondary emotion, meaning that there is something underneath the anger that is producing the anger. Be very, very suspicious of your anger and be very careful what you do with it. And being angry and quoting the Bible is a very dangerous combination. And most likely what you're going to end up doing is adding to the suffering of that person. Christians will sometimes talk about righteous anger and righteous indignation. And you know what? They're very, very hard for people to achieve. Be very suspicious of anger. James 1 will say, the anger, your anger does not produce God's righteousness. Don't go there. I have a hard enough time controlling the sinful part of me when I'm not angry. Okay? That's just Ben. So anger's up there. I identify with that one. Be very, very careful with anger. Secondly, let's be humble. The other day, I was playing blocks with Rosalind, and I grabbed a pentagon really quickly, and I tried to put it into the slot where it was going. It's this little hollow truck, and it only would only fit the pentagon slot, and I couldn't get it in. What's going on? Well, I didn't look properly, but I actually needed a hexagon, not a pentagon. I had missed that there was another side. And that's pretty important for us, because at a glance, problems often look the same. And at a glance, we often think that we have the answer. We have the solution. I know what fits here. Let's walk humbly. Let's walk humbly when people present problems, and we know the solution. We know that we know, and then we start to get angry about it too, and it gets even worse. Don't force people to fit your explanations. You may have my pentagon problem. Let's be humble. And even when you have the right explanation, we still walk humbly, because getting angry and giving them the right solution is probably going to create a barrier to them receiving that. I'm not suggesting that you can't offer suggestions, but we offer them humbly. Let's talk about suffering with friends. When a friend is suffering, you don't need to have an answer for them. The best thing that Job's friends did was sit with him and lament. And we have talked about that. But let's just remind ourselves, friends, that the pressure is off. You don't have to have an answer. Our role is to be a friend. And we'll engage in those conversations, you know, as we're being a friend. But, you know, let's not front-end load the anger and the answers to all of their problems and end up sort of importing our baggage on them. Let's learn to be a friend by being with people who suffer without having to tell them all of the solutions to their problems. Often it doesn't end well. What should the friends have done? This week, I was talking to Sarah Bender at our in-person worship service here on Thursday night. And I said, hi to Sarah Bender, how you doing? And she said the first thing that she said to me was, great, I had this like God encounter this week. So she shared it with me. It was just a fantastic story of what Job's friends should have done. And so I asked Sarah if she would share that story. So Sarah, are you ready to go? Are you able to share that story with us still?
Can people see me and hear me? Yes. Okay.
Yes. Hi, Sarah. Thanks.
Hello. You're welcome. So my story starts just with living in the country and trying to meet your neighbors. We've only lived in the country 2.5 years, and in the 21st century, things have changed in the country. Not everybody who lives here are farmers, so we don't necessarily know these people through farming circles. And unfortunately, because of rural crime, many, if not most of our neighbors all have gates on the end of their driveway. So to meet your neighbors is a tricky thing. You have to plan it right. You have to see the moment and you have to seize on the moment. And I can be honest and say that I don't always do that. So I was on my way home from work, and one of my neighbors that I still haven't met, I saw a vehicle on the outside of the gate and the lady standing outside of her vehicle. And I could tell she had it, one of those plug-in tire inflators was plugged in. And I could just tell that really quickly. And I buzzed on past. And there was that voice inside of me that said, no, you're turning around. So I stopped the car. I turned around, pulled into the edge of the driveway. And I rolled my window down and I said, can I help you? And she said, I locked my phone in the house and I really, really need it. And I need, could you phone this number for me? I said, absolutely. So I pulled up my cell phone and away we start dialing and we didn't get any answer. And as I'm sitting there, I said, can I just ask you, I said, who lives in this house? And she said to me, she said, Jack and Marilyn. And she said, but Marilyn died January 8th. And all of a sudden it was just this, oh my word. Okay. So this woman that I saw last summer tending to her flowers is no longer here. So in the few little minutes, all of a sudden she said, oh, here comes Jack. And he must have got the message somehow that this is his soon to be daughter-in-law. And she had locked her phone in the house. So in pulls Jack. And at that moment, I could have thought to myself, okay, this maybe isn't the best opportunity to meet my neighbor. I know he's in tremendous amounts of grief. It's been 2 months. But I thought to myself, no, this is what I train for. This is my job. I walk into people's pain and suffering and disease and impending death. And this is what I do. So here we go. So I drove into his driveway and I stuck out my hand and I said, my name is Sarah. This is where I live. We're the next farm over. And I said, I understand that you lost your wife recently. And he said, yes. He said, she died January 8th. And I just said, I'm so, so sorry for your loss. And I started asking those hard questions. I said, how are you doing? And he said, I tell people I'm fine, but he said, but I'm not. And I said, I understand. So I got out of my car. We talked. We talked about her disease, her death, how fast it went from the time that she was diagnosed to the time she died was 8 months. It just really blew him over. And he was very raw and we had a very raw conversation. It was not your typical, this is how you meet your next door neighbor conversation. We're crying and I'm chatting with him and just saying, and so eventually the question came up and I said to him, Jack, how can I be your neighbor for you right now? And I said, are you eating? I said, did Marilyn cook most of your meals? And he said, yeah, she did. He said, she spent the last 6 months of her life trying to teach me how to do this stuff. I said, okay. I said, food is my love language. I want to help you. I want to be there for you. So I said, can I get your number? Can I text you? Can I keep in contact with you? He said, I'd like that very much. And then at the very end, I said, very un-COVID, I said, can I please give you a hug? I said, yeah. And he was crying and I was crying. And I gave him a hug and he couldn't even look at me because he was crying and he walked away. And I drove out of that driveway and I just thought to myself, God, that was so important for me to listen to that little voice today. And I could have just buzzed right on past, but this was so important today. So I came home and I was just like this. I was crying and I said to Kevin, that was such a God encounter. Because it was just not your usual, hello, I'm your neighbor conversation. And actually it's interesting, Ben, because even aside from what I told you, because that's where it ended. And so I came home and I said, I need to know now and I need to pray. And I'll ask all of you to pray that I would know how to be a neighbor to Jack, that I would know when to text and when to call and when to push in a little bit and say, why don't you come when we can, why don't you come for supper? Those little things, but what's interesting too, what has happened in the meantime is that yesterday, Jack's next door neighbor, as next door neighbors as you can be in the country, his next door neighbor, Terry, and him are very good friends. And Terry is checking in on Jack to make sure Jack's okay. And I don't really know Terry. I've met him once in passing, but apparently Jack relayed my meeting with him to Terry and how much it meant to him So Terry contacts Kevin because he has Kevin's number and says, you just need to tell your wife how much that meant to him and how much a hug goes a long ways. And as a result, we spent 3 hours at Terry's house yesterday getting to know him and his girlfriend. And as it so happens, his girlfriend Evelyn has a brain tumor. And on Tuesday, she will find out what is going on with her brain tumor, whether it's cancerous, whether it's malignant, whether it's benign. So not only that, I know we have another neighbor that is just a little further down the road, and he has the same cancer that Jack's wife Marilyn has, and he's actively in the process of passing away right now. And so I'm surrounded by a lot of suffering, and I would implore your prayers to have wisdom to know what to do and how to be a neighbor to these people in these really, really tricky times. So if you can continue to pray for that, and also to listen to those little voices when they say it's, you need to turn around your vehicle and go back. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, friends.
Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you for being an example of a neighbor, the way that Jesus defines it, the way that Job's friends should have been. Let's thank you for that. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for the way that you put together these appointments, the way that you have been at work in Sarah's life to the point where she recognizes when you're speaking and saying, turn around, and then stay put and ask these questions. So Lord, thank you for that. Reward her for it. And I pray for these individuals, for Jack and for Evelyn and for the other neighbor with cancer. I pray for the two neighbors with cancer, especially Evelyn. May it be benign, Lord. And Lord, for Jack, comfort. We're praying comfort and peace. And may he see through Sarah, through Kevin, through their family, your love. May he not see simply a human neighbor extending human compassion, but a divine being extending divine compassion through his image bearers. And so, Lord, I pray that you would do more than we can ask or imagine in these situations, and that you would bless the vendors with the strength and the wisdom and the words and the grace and the ability to be Jesus to neighbors who need it. And Lord, I pray this for all of us. Lord, we want to be friends who can be with a friend without needing to give an answer for their suffering, without needing to fit them into our particular box. Lord, would you make us people who are humble enough to listen for what you are doing and saying in the moment? And when we can't pick that up, may we not speak for you when you're not asking us to. Lord, lead and guide us. Being with those who suffer is such a difficult thing, and it brings out so many of our insecurities as well. So Lord, I pray that we would be peaceful and secure in you, and then may that be received to others. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayers for ourselves, for our friends, for our neighbors. We bless you, Lord, and we thank you. Thank you for your word. Thank you for using us. Amen. Well, thanks for being with us. And now, may the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Go in peace, my friends.